So good evening and welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for what is going to be a super exciting course called Jupernatural. JLI are usually excellent with their titles, but I think this time they hit it out of the park. So I'm really excited about this one. It's kind of unique among courses that we've done. Many different topics, of course, and various different subjects within Judaism, but this is unique in that we are going to be discussing the mysterious, the paranormal, things that are beyond the typical reality that we live in and that we are used to engaging with on a day-to-day basis. So before we actually start, just a couple things. Number one, if you are taking your first ever JLI course, please raise your hand. Okay, nice. So at least a handful of first-time JLI students, which is always incredible. We love seeing our regular friends returning, and we also love seeing new faces, and that is a great sign. I think it's worthwhile to take a very quick minute for everyone just to very quickly introduce yourself. That way, I know some of you know each other, but I want to make sure that everyone knows everyone, so you could just say your name very quickly. We'll start from me, and then we'll go over to my right side. So Rabbi Yossi Zach Lekovsky here. I'm sure most of you know me. For those who are meeting me for the first time, it was great to meet you, and I hope it will be the first of many more. Go ahead.
Diane's way back. Marlene Robinson.
Mike Berkey.
Colin Cantor.
Linda Cantor.
Stuart Zuckerbrot.
Ali Tabakoli.
Lou Diamond.
Marion Bell.
Bernadine Franklin.
Yoav Jomiti.
Dale Hertz.
Tyler Porter.
Jamie Bijou.
Hetty Bijou.
And Deborah Eisenberg.
Barbara Lutzman.
Heather, wonderful. Thank you and welcome. By the way, there's a few seats at the table, so feel free to find one of them, as well as a, we want to pass this to Heather, please. This is the first session for tonight. One more thing. I just want to welcome a guest tonight who's over there in the back. It's Mark Asnin, who you're looking at. He is an award-winning photographer from New York City, and he's actually working on a book about the global Chabad community. And I think it's 15 years in the making, and he's nearing the end. But he couldn't come to the finish line without visiting this Chabad right here. And we understand that. So it would be incomplete. So we welcome you. Thank you for joining. Just hit the number one, please, on the phone. Well, she walked around. So maybe just make sure that. Yeah, sorry about that. Thank you. Mark, whose work has appeared in all the most prestigious works in this country and beyond, New York Times, Newsweek, etc., he is an award-winning photographer. He actually also photographed the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the early 90s, and a picture of the Rebbe that appeared on the front page of the New York Times magazine for the Rebbe's 90th birthday in March of 1992. And ever since then, he's been visiting with the global Chabad community. So thank you for being here, and just make sure you're smiling and sitting up straight, okay? Because you never know where your picture is going to end up. Okay, so with that, I think we are ready to jump in. You may be surprised or not to learn that in recent years, interest in the paranormal has actually been increasing, including among young people. So, if I ask you, by raise of hand, how many of you are would consider yourself that you believe in spirit, that spiritual energy could be found in physical objects, just by quickly raising your hand? If
yes.
You okay. How about in psychics? Okay, reincarnation. How about reincarnation? Just kidding. How about astrology? Okay. Believe in at least one of the four entities. Okay, and by the way, that's 62% that believe in at least one of these four. So, like I said, it's actually an increasing number of people. And just so we know, very briefly, what we're going to be covering in these classes, tonight we're going to be discussing dreams, and of course, specifically the Jewish perspective on dreams, and that's why we're here, for the Jewish perspective. Next week, lesson number two, we'll be talking about the stars and astrology. Lesson three will be on the evil eye, as well as curses, if they are real, and if what Judaism says about those. And finally, in the fourth lesson, we will be talking about angels and demons. And we may even mention those tonight, actually.
You didn't ask one question. How many of us make a living doing these things?
I didn't ask a lot of questions. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you for being here. And we will... The topics are all exciting, and welcome. Are you
Carlos?
Welcome. Do we have a seat? If you'd like, by the way, feel free. Let's pull that table over and connect it to where Anna is sitting. Tyler, thank you. Just line it up with the table where Anna is, and you can feel free to take a seat. Pull up chairs right behind you, and. Wonderful. Great job. We may be hiring you for the weekly room setup. Okay. So, we are just about ready to plumb the depths of this wonderful topic. And we are going to open our lesson tonight, which will be on the meaning of dreams. We're going to open it with a lesson video, which we typically have if this is your first JLI class. So it will begin momentarily.
...900 feet long, 175 feet from keel to funnel. Bearing over 2,000 souls, including several of the world's wealthiest. Experts had crowned it the unsinkable, and it was making good time on its maiden voyage. One Jewish man, though, battled a feeling of unease. Isaac Frauenfeld was born in Pennsylvania in October 1868, on the Jewish festival of Hoshana Rabbah, meaning Great Salvation. He opened a law practice in New York, and in March 1912, he traveled to Nice, France, to attend his brother Henry's wedding to Clara Rogers. The newlyweds journeyed on to the English port city of Southampton to ride the luxurious Titanic back to New York. And why not? A new life, a new ship, a liner predicted to live happily ever after. Isaac chose a scenic route through France, boarding the Titanic at Cherbourgen the day after Passover. He paid today's equivalent of $4,000 for a first-class ticket. But he was jittery. Days earlier, he had an awful dream. He saw himself aboard a colossal steamship that crashed headlong into something large and began to sink beneath the waves. He awoke shaken, but dismissed the dream, because he believed neither in dreams nor the supernatural. The night before boarding, his dream reoccurred, an oceanic collision, helplessly sinking, escape. But the sun rose, and so did he, a lot less certain than before. Was there anything to this? Should he board the Titanic? Should he share his dream? No, they would mock him. The ship was unsinkable. Isaac quietly boarded the Titan of the sea, but he later found a moment to share his fearful vision. As expected, he was roundly ridiculed. Until 4 nights later, when, at 11:40 on April 14th, the ship's lookout spotted a colossal iceberg dead ahead. The Titanic reversed its mighty engines and lurched to the left, but its starboard was lacerated. Ice tore into steel, and water dragged the ship's throat downwards. Isaac heard the captain express terror and ran to rouse Henry and Clara. Too many passengers refused to abandon ship at midnight, unable to believe that a lifeboat was safer than an Olympic liner. But Isaac had seen this vessel sink twice already. As he rolled into a lifeboat, he said, "Well, Henry, I wasn't so foolish, was I?" Henry wasn't sure. Surely such an engineering wonder could remain afloat until it could be repaired or towed. But the Titanic's stern rose into the air with hundreds clinging on. Snapping clean in two, the vessel plunged into the eternal silence of a bottomless ocean. 1,500 souls were lost. A nightmare, a reality, in the heart of the night. One sunrise and 6 hours later, Isaac was hoisted aboard the Carpathia, which sailed on to New York. He no longer doubted that something had forewarned him about the disaster. Isaac Frauenthal dismissed his disturbing dreams and sailed aboard the Titanic. If you had been in his position, would you have done the same?
So, I guess that's the question. If you had been in Isaac Frauenthal's position, would you have boarded the Titanic? Very quick responses, please.
Depends if you can get your money back.
Okay, that's a Jewish answer. Anyone else?
Yes.
Raise your hand if you would have still boarded if you were Isaac. Raise your hand if you would not have boarded. And raise your hand if you are unsure. Okay. Another quick question. And just, thank God we have a nice sized group here. So questions that are necessary in order that you kind of can't move forward without asking, we welcome those. Other topics, which may be a little bit broader, I'm happy to take them afterwards at the end of the class. I'm in no rush, and I'll stay on to take questions afterwards. But again, if they are relevant on the spot, feel free to, we will have opportunities to ask those questions. We'll take just a few volunteers. Have you ever had a dream that seemed very real to you? And if yes, how did you respond to it? If you can briefly share, if you're comfortable doing so. If not, I understand. Do we have any volunteers? Stuart.
I've actually had quite a few recently that have been very, very vivid and very real. I have a good friend who is a psychologist who is an expert in dream interpretation. Usually I share them with her and figure out what they mean. And often they're very, very different from anything I would have come up with.
And accurate?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That's good. One more, Stanley?
I've had the same kind of dream twice in my life, separated by over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And it was where a particular form of a person came to me and gave me directives about the behavior that I should engage in at very significant times in my life. And I followed the directives.
Wow. Wow, very interesting, and thank you both for sharing. Very briefly, when I was in Israel in 2017, I'm not going to get into all the details, but I stayed in this moshav, was the family of a bar mitzvah boy that we went to Israel with. Shabbat afternoon, I was hanging out with some of the people there, and this one guy, and maybe in his late 30s or early 40s, shared with me the following. He and his wife were married and not blessed with children for quite a while, for sure more than 10 years. I'm forgetting if it was 11 or over 15. And he and his wife had become more religious, and they were not blessed. And he says that one night, he said, I'm just telling you exactly what he said. He said, I'm not somebody who remembers dreams ever. And then once I had this dream, and he said he saw the image of the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but he's not a Chabadnik. He said he doesn't have any, he doesn't consider himself a Chabadnik, he's not tied into Chabad, but everyone knows what the Rebbe looks like, so he can be identified in a dream. And the Rebbe came to him and said that, he told him in Hebrew, Hayeled Shalcha Biyad Shimon, four words, your child is in the hands of Shimon. So he called his friend who lived nearby. This is like in the upper Galilee of Israel. And his friend says, well, perhaps that means that we should both go pray together at the tomb of Rabbi Shimon, Bar Yochai, which is in the north of Israel, in Miron. And they did that sometime after. And she was pregnant with twins. When I was visiting him, she was pregnant with twins. And we stayed in touch, and he messaged me when the babies were born. Of course, became a wonderful blessing for him and their family. So these things are real. The question is, when do we know if they're real or if they aren't real? What is the criteria? How do we determine whether we should take a particular dream seriously? That's the question. Now, when we talk about dreams, you know, sometimes we say to someone, well, you're dreaming. And that usually means that they're dreaming, it's not happening. But sometimes we say, I have a dream to do X, Y, and Z. But then we really mean it. We really aspire and want to achieve whatever that is that we have in mind. So it can go either way. And what's interesting is that we're gonna tap into biblical wisdom first, but hopefully we'll get some insight in how to determine if we should attribute value to a particular dream, as well as if there's anything we can do about nightmares. Right, raise your hand if you've experienced a nightmare in the last 12 months. Okay, a nice number of you, maybe the majority. So is there anything that we can do to perhaps avoid them? So we will try to discover that too. Did you have a question?
No, you were something to do for the nightmares.
What's that?
Before going to bed.
Great one. That's going to be one of the things. You want to give the class? thank you for sharing that. But we'll come back to it towards the end. Can anyone here think of a dream that's recorded in the book of Genesis? A raise of hand and just make reference to it if you could think of it. In the book of Genesis, a dream. Joseph and his dreams. Anyone else?
Jacob.
Yes. Which one? Specifically? The ladder, right? The famous ladder. Anyone else?
The Pharaoh.
Pharaoh and his dreams. Yes, thank you.
And
thank
the
you.
Servants.
Yes. So actually, on page 6 in your student book, you will find the number of dreams that are recorded in the book of Genesis that appear, and there we're not going to go through them, but they are here for your reference. But of all the dreams on this list, there's one described by the Torah in great detail, okay, and that was made reference to. We have Pharaoh's dream. So very briefly, what was Pharaoh's dream? Pharaoh's dream was that he saw first seven lean cows and seven robust cows emerging from the Nile River, and then the lean cows swallowed up the robust cows, but they were unrecognizable, meaning the lean cows remained lean even after they swallowed up the robust cows. The same thing happened with ears of grain. again, lean and robust, healthy looking. They swallowed them up, but it was still unnoticeable that they actually did that. So, so what did Pharaoh do, of course? He turned to his dream interpreters. Perhaps they weren't as good as yours, Stuart. And he wasn't getting any salvation. He tried, and of course, I'm sure they were getting a very good salary, but they really couldn't satisfy anything that he was hearing from them. So, eventually, he was told about Joseph, and Joseph came and served as the interpreter of his dream. Now, this story highlights one issue. The first problem with deriving meaning from dreams. And that is, for starters, we have to know this. Just because a dream has meaning, it does not mean that we're going to know what the meaning is. In other words, if Joseph wasn't around when Pharaoh needed him, he knew his dream, it had meaning, as we know that it did, but none of his interpreters were able to do the job. In other words, there would have been a dream, but it's possible that we would have never known the interpretation of the dream. So that's important to remember. That's number one. In other words, dream interpretation is a complex art. And perhaps in earlier generations, there were those who were more skilled at it, maybe a little bit less so nowadays. So that's number one. Number two, in addition to Joseph being a great dream interpreter, he was also a great dreamer. So, we all know his dream. His dreams were, the first of the two was that he and his brothers were gathering sheaves of grain out in the field, and eventually all of the sheaves that belonged to his brothers bowed down to his. And then he had another dream, that the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to him as well. So, very nice. Now, did this dream come to fruition? It did. Joseph became the viceroy of Egypt, the second in command, and his brothers and his father eventually came, and they bowed down to him. But here's something very important that we learn. In the dream, he saw the sun and the moon bowing down to him. What did the sun refer to? To his father, to Jacob. Who did the moon refer to?
His mother.
His mother. However, by the time he had these dreams, his mother already wasn't alive. And most certainly, she didn't come to Egypt to bow down. In other words, very important teaching the Talmud gives us is that even when there is a dream that you may have that has value, nonetheless, there will still be details that are meaningless in every dream. And we're going to read text number two, where we get this teaching. And I am going to ask Lou on my left to begin, if you're comfortable doing so. By the way, when it comes to readings of text, we'll just move from person to person. If you prefer not to read, just feel free to pass the microphone over to the next person, no problem at all. So text number two is on page 8, and this is out of the Talmud, tractate Brachot.
Rabbi Yochanan taught in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, just as there can never be wheat without chaff mixed in, so too there can never be a dream without nonsense mixed in. Rabbi Rachia taught, even though part of a dream may be fulfilled, the entirety of the dream is never fulfilled. The source for these statements is found in the story of Joseph's dreams. Joseph dreamed that the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me, referring to his parents and 11 siblings. Yet, at the time of the dream, Joseph's mother was already deceased.
Thank you. So from this Talmud teaching, we have the statement, Ein chalom belo dvarim betelim. There's no such thing as a dream without some nonsense, even if there is a lot of value to it. Yes?
I disagree. I think that the stuff that you would consider nonsense might just be like a microcosmic macrocosmic maybe the dream is more of a macrocosmic.
Well, it could be on some spiritual plane his mother bowed down to him. That's possible. But in the reality of this world, it didn't happen. Anything else quick? Yes.
No, I have a quick question because, you know, for example, I have a life situation last week that I think that I influenced my mind to dream about it. So it was more like a reactive dream.
Excellent point.
Versus what I'm looking for is the ones that they may tell you something that you said, that something show up with no connection.
We will see. We will see. Thank you for mentioning that. We're going to be addressing it. So what do we have so far? One thing that we learn is that dream having meaning does not necessarily mean that we will know the meaning. Number two, lessons regarding dreams in the Bible. Some dreams are meaningful. Think about this. We have how many in that list in the whole book of Genesis? Maybe six or seven, whatever, dreams recorded. How many dreams actually happened during the whole, for the extent of the occurrences of the entire book of Genesis, which is roughly a couple thousand years, how many dreams were dreamt? Millions, right? How many are actually in the Bible? Just a few, right? In other words, not every dream has meaning. So some dreams are meaningful. The Bible didn't tell us everything that occurred during those years. It only shared with us information that's important and valuable for us to have so that we can learn from it, including some of those dreams. So which tells us that only some are meaningful. Then number two, dream interpretation is not simple, that we established, because Pharaoh struggled with it until he found Joseph. And number three, dreams are never entirely accurate, according to the Talmud, and therefore we should, and we'll see more about that soon actually, but this is very important information before we even advance. So this is what we have from the biblical dreams that are recorded and shared. All right? Making sense? Thank you. Wonderful. So let's advance and go from biblical to the Talmudic. Let's see what the Talmud has to say about dreams. And here we're going to experience something a little bit interesting, because we're going to find very different perspectives in the Talmud as far as dreams are concerned. And we're going to get some general attitudes towards dreams that we find in the Talmud. We're going to start with text number 3 on page number 10, a very short text. Would you like to read it in English, please, for us, Ali?
Sure. A dream is 1/60 of prophecy.
Thank you. A dream is 1/60 of prophecy. In other words, the Talmud is telling us something really important. Prophecy, we know, and we discussed this, I believe, in last course, in Book Smart, for those who participated. So prophecy means a communication, a very clear communication, usually very clear, from God to the prophet. What are we saying here about dreams? That dreams are a 60th of prophecy. In other words, if we want to say that dreams are a waste of time, we would say that. But we're actually saying that they are somewhat associated with prophecy. Yes, it's only a 60th. And by the way, when it says 60th, it doesn't actually mean the ratio of 1 to 60. In the Talmud, the number of 1, the ratio of 1 to 60 is a common number just to describe an association. In other words, if it was less than a 60th, it would mean it's insignificant. 1 to 60 means that it's significant. So what's the idea we're being told here? That when it comes to dreams, they are a fraction of actual prophecy, which means that we're raising the profile of dreams to something pretty serious. To say that they're actually somewhat, even somewhat on par with prophecy. So this is number one. And actually, if you look on page 11, we're not going to go through all of them, but there's a section in the Talmud in Tractate Brachot towards the end, and in the page, well, probably says the pages here, yeah, page 56, 57, and it's a lengthy discussion there about dreams, and it actually says that various different things, a bunch of different things, that if you see that in your dream, it actually tells you what it means. So if you're looking at the page, on page 11, there's various activities that if you see them, they mean something. Most of them have a good meaning. There's a bunch of animals that if you see them, have a specific meaning. If you see a snake, what do you think? Is that good or bad? It's actually good. It's actually good because like us, if you see a snake in a dream, it means that you're going to find your livelihood very easily. Like a snake, it eats and gets its food very easy on the ground. So you never know. And after the class or on your own time, you're free to read through these. Then we have various plants and fruits that if you see them, they have particular meaning. Very fascinating stuff. I would definitely encourage you to read it. So we had one Talmudic source, and yet here we have another one, which comes from Tractate Shabbat. I will ask Stuart to please read it for us, text number 4 on page 14 in the English.
Rabbi Yehoshua, the son of Rabbi Edi, visited the home of Rav Ashi. His host prepared a third-born calf and offered it to him. Rav Ashi responded, "I am observing a fast." They countered, "Do you not agree with the ruling of Rav Yehuda that a person may break a self-imposed fast and repay his obligation by fasting on a different day?" Rav Ashi replied, "This is a fast due to a bad dream. Rav Bar Mech Asiya taught in the name of Rav Hama Bar Goya, who taught in the name of Rav, that a fast nullifies the portents of a bad dream, like fire consumes flax. And Rav Hista stipulated that the fast is most effective when observed on the day of the dream. Rav Yosef added that such a fast may even be observed on Shabbat."
Thank you very much. So what do we, let's unpack this Talmudic teaching here. Let's break it down. What are the messages here? So first of all, what we're learning here is that the sages, this particular sage, he took his dream, a bad dream, very seriously. And it meant that it had to do with something, some bad omen for the future. Now, it was serious enough, not only that he wanted to fast as a result of it, but he even was fasting on Shabbat. Now, we all know that we honor Shabbat. One of the ways we honor Shabbat is with eating our favorite foods, right? That's why we say that Shabbat calories don't count, because otherwise we wouldn't touch it. But it's actually a mitzvah. All week long, it's a mitzvah that when you eat, you should eat kosher. But there's no mitzvah to eat. I mean, of course, it's a mitzvah to be healthy and take care of your body. But on Shabbat, we actually have a mitzvah to eat. We honor Shabbat by eating. And yet, this sage went ahead and fasted, even on Shabbat, because of his dream. In other words, this was really serious, because we don't fast on Shabbat ever, with one exception. Anyone know?
Yom Kippur.
Excellent. If Yom Kippur coincides with Shabbat, then it overrides the mitzvah to eat, and we do fast. And this is another exception. Of course, we don't do it unless it's an extreme. But this particular sage was fasting on Shabbat because he wanted to try to get over this bad dream that he had. Now, what does fasting achieve?
Purification.
Purification. Yeah, we can say it's repentance. It makes you, when you're a little bit withdrawn from physicality, you're more open and to spirituality, to God, to reflecting. So that was the purpose. That's why we fast multiple times a year, of course, on Yom Kippur as well. And this is what he wanted to achieve by fasting on Shabbat. Now, that's one important takeaway, that he took his bad dream very seriously. But another thing, another takeaway, was that the fact that he had a bad dream with something being foretold negative about the future did not mean that it was written in stone. Your fate, in that case his fate wasn't sealed. There's no such thing as something being written in stone that cannot be undone. If it can't be undone, why would he waste his time fasting? obviously, if he was fasting, it means that there's a way to be able to change things and have your story or your destiny rewritten through reflection, through repentance, through seeking perhaps some atonement that was necessary. So again, two very important points. Number one, he took it seriously, but number two, it wasn't a sentence written in stone. He was able and understood that you can undo it. So this point is brought home in text number 5 by an important a great sage. Tells you here his short bio. You can read later on, but he wrote a work on dreams, and he includes the following in text number 5. Linda, please.
A person who has had a bad dream should not say, "The decree has already been sealed and all hope is lost." The possibility of rectification through repentance and supplication is always available, even for the worst dream imaginable. This person should fast, repent, and pray for mercy. If one does so, God will accept the fast, repentance, and prayer, and he will cancel all negative decrees that were issued. The negative events portended by the dream will be revoked swiftly. Like fire consumes flax, they will be revoked completely, just as fire consumes flax completely without leaving any remnant, unlike wood, which always leaves some remnant after being burned.
Thank you. So we have two takeaways in this comparison of the fire and repentance comparison. Number one, the decree will be revoked as swiftly as fire consumes flax, so you could undo it very quickly. And number two, the decree will be completely abolished like fire consumes flax without leaving any remnant behind. So this is an important comparison because number one, you can undo it quickly. Number two, you can do it thoroughly and completely. Okay, so what do we have so far from the Talmud about dreams? Number one, it's like prophecy. Number two, the sage took it really seriously and fasted on Shabbat in order to avert the potential decree that he got in this dream. But there's another whole side to the Talmud's attitude towards dreams. And for that, let's continue. Let's hear the other side of the story. Colin, would you like to do a reading for us?
Rabbi Shmuel.
Number 6.
Three?
Yeah.
Not in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. People are only shown their dreams, the products of their dreams, of their own thoughts. The Roman Empire once said to Rabbi Nun, the son of Rabbi
Hananiah.
The Jews claim to be very wise. Tell me then, what will I see in my dream tonight? Rabbi Yochanan replied, you will see the Persian capture and enslave you and force you to herd pigs with a golden staff. The emperor thought about his vision all day. At night, he saw it in his dream.
Keep going.
King Trevor 1:7. You Jews claim to be very wise. Tell me then, what will I see in my dreams tonight? Mel replied, you will see the Romans take you captive and force you to grind date pits with a golden mill. The king thought of this vision all day. At night, he saw it in his dream.
So the sages had some fun with these global leaders. But what does this tell you? What does this tell you instead of dreams being some divine communication or something prophetic? Is just a result of what you were thinking throughout the day. That doesn't seem to be so substantial. He got them to think about whatever, and they thought about it, and that's what they dreamed. So we have another whole perspective here from the Talmud, and it doesn't sound like dreams are to be taken seriously, because it's just whatever it's your imagination gone wild, that's what you're dreaming about. So we have something very different here. And I'm going to share another Talmudic teaching in one moment, but it needs a little introduction about one idea. Something quick, Carlos.
In the year Mayahu 29, it says like you yourself to dream. I forgot which one, but I left 29:89 maybe. Says
maybe we'll come back to it, okay? If that's okay. So, in Jewish law, we all know the concept of tithing, right? But these laws are not so simple. There's multiple different tithes that we take, today it's a little bit more straightforward and simple. But in temple days, back in the day in Jerusalem when the temple stood, so there was a whole series of tithes that one needed to give from their produce. Very brief, because I just want to get to one point that's relevant for our conversation today. And that is that the first thing you did was you gave like 2% of everything to the Kohen, to the priest. And that was called teruma. That's like a contribution to the priests that served in the temple. Then you gave 10% to the Levite. And then in certain years, you gave another 10%, but that was called the second tithe. Okay, the first went to the Levite. The next tithe, the second tithe, was a little unique. You didn't give it away. You were able to keep it, but it would become sacred. You were allowed to eat it, but there was specifics of where you're allowed to eat it. You could eat it, but only in Jerusalem. Now, what does that mean, only in Jerusalem? So the average Jewish person back then made the trip, the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, generally three times a year, for the three major biblical holidays. Where we are right now, actually, is between two of them. We had Passover a little over, actually in 2 days will be a month from a month back, and then Shavuot is in about 3.5 weeks from now. So, and then the third, of course, is Sukkot. But if you only go during one of these holidays, then it means you would hold on to this produce for months, possibly even 6 months in some instances, until you would be able to take it to Jerusalem and eat it. It's also not so practical. I mean, if you had a serious farm, how are you going to schlep everything to Jerusalem with you? So this is what they did. If you, whatever amount you had, you were allowed to swap it for money. Let's just say I had $100 worth of produce. I take $100 and I swap the two, which means that the produce now becomes just neutral. It's not holy anymore. But this $100 now takes on the sanctity of that was on the produce. And then the next time I go to Jerusalem, I take this $100 with me. And when I'm there, it's a little easier to schlep $100 than a lot of produce. When I'm there, I buy food and I eat it in Jerusalem. And in so doing, you're also supporting the Jerusalem economy. Okay, this is just an introduction to the next text that we're going to be reading, which is a wild one and is very insightful. So, Mike, text number 7, please, also the Talmud.
A person was troubled about the whereabouts of money that his deceased father left for him. He dreamed that his father told him exactly how much money it was and where it could be found, but that it was consecrated as Maser Shini.
Second tithe.
Second tithe. He went to the specified place and indeed found the specified sum of money. The sages instructed this person that the contents of dreams are irrelevant and he need not treat the money as Maser Shini.
Do you hear what's going on here? So somebody got a communication from his deceased father how much money he left him and where he left it. Because the son didn't know. He knew that his father left him money, but he had no clue where it was. And, you know, back then, people put their money away in various different places. Who knows? And he couldn't find it. So in the dream, he got this communication of how much it is and where it is. But his father also told him that this money is actually sacred second tithe money. In other words, you can't just spend it on whatever you want. You have to take it to Jerusalem and spend it there and eat whatever you buy there. So He went to the location that he was told to go to in the dream. Found the money, the right place, and the precise amount. However, his father told him that it was second tithe money. It's sacred. So he went to the sages to ask, what do I do? And they told him that disregard that component. It's regular money. You could do whatever you want with it. Just don't spend it all in one place. That's it. So the Talmud is giving us a very fascinating teaching here, that although the dream was valid because he found the money, that amount in that particular space, yet the sages told him that dreams do not dictate Jewish law. It's not how it works. A dream doesn't have the ability to decide the status of what money is, if it's sacred money or not sacred. We don't attribute that power to a dream. In other words, what is the Talmud saying? That dreams, okay, it's very nice that you got a hold of the money from a dream, but a dream doesn't really have value, and it can't really give us or dictate anything about the halachic legal status of money. So, we have here a very different perspective than the first one. Again, it's the same source, same Talmud. First we said the Talmud told us that dreams are akin, somewhat akin to prophecy. Now we're saying that first we said that dreams are just a result of somebody's imagination, whatever you think about during the day. And now we're saying that a dream, the sages have said a dream could not dictate what the status of that money was. So how do we reconcile these two perspectives on dreams coming from the Talmud? Any quick ideas?
Well, does it depend on the circumstance? Because this is directly correlated to Jewish law, where maybe the other dreams were not exactly.
And then what? If it isn't Jewish law, then? I mean, we saw from the emperor how he just told him, you know, some idea, he thought about it, and that was the dream. In other words, that's just what it is. It's our imaginations. It's whatever we think about.
So it's any reason if they are like, if you were not manipulated, then it has more weight than something that was not manipulated? Like, because there is a distinction there, right, between manipulation or not manipulation at least?
Not necessarily. It was just highlighting the fact that it's whatever is in your mind. In that case, they put it into their mind. But we'll see. Okay, so let's advance here. And the Talmud itself actually is going to give us the distinction in between these different scenarios. We'll go to text number 8. Marlene, would you like to read for us, please? Text number 8, also from the Talmud.
Rava raised a contradiction between two verses. In one verse, God says, I speak with the prophet in a dream. Numbers 12, 6. But a second verse states, dreams speak falsely, Zechariah 10:2. The Talmud resolves this. There are two types of dreams. Some come by means of an angel, and some come by means of a demon.
Thank you. So now we're being told that there's two different sources for dreams. And now it's all going to be reconciled. When the dreams are valuable, they have a message, something worthwhile, it's because they are coming from an angel. And the ones that are just a waste of time are coming from a different source. Here we're calling it demons. And we're not going to discuss angels and demons much today. We're going to get back to it in lesson 4. But we know that angels, of course, are spiritual beings. They're agents of the divine. The truth is, we're not going to get into it now, but demons are also. And demons are basically the impure counterpart of angels, also spiritual beings, but the unholy and the impure. So it depends where it's coming from. So let's take a look here. So they may be coming from angels, they may be coming from demons. If it's coming from angels, that angels which are positive spiritual forces, and they occupy the heavenly realm. Where do angels hang out? They hang out in the heavenly realms, where our soul visits while we sleep. So here's a very important idea, and that is that what happens when we go to sleep? And I'm not sure if we actually quote it here, but it's in the Talmud somewhere. And that is, just like we said, we used that 1 to 60 ratio before about dream versus prophecy. So we have this in the Talmud about a different idea. And that is that sleep is a 60th of death. Now, what happens when somebody leaves this world and passes away? We've discussed this at length in other courses too. So what happens basically is that the soul and the body experience an uncoupling, we'll say. While they're here, the soul and the body are very much intertwined, and you can't have one without the other, and the soul vivifies the body, every aspect of it, but then the soul departs and returns to its abode, to its heavenly abode. When we say that sleep is a 60th of death, it means that something of that is also happening when we go to sleep at night. Of course, with God's help, we wake up the next morning. So it's not quite, but it's a 60th. Again, it means that there's a semblance of the theme that exists within sleep too. What happens when we go to sleep? Our soul ascends on high, again, to a degree. And once it's in the heavenly realm, it's possible for our soul to be engaged with angels while it's in heaven overnight. When does that happen? That happens based on what our day was like. If we spent our day in a productive way and our minds were engaged in Torah and wisdom and more elevated, refined things, then when we go to sleep at night, our soul is, so to speak, primed to be able to engage with the angels. But when our day looks very different and we just were engaged in materialism and that defined the day, then when our soul ascends on high, it's not really going to encounter angels, and it may encounter other things. Let's see another very beautiful text. This is from Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the sixth Rebbe of Chabad, and he had a very unique writing style. And he writes about this in his flowery style, let's say. Diane, would you like to read text number 9 for us?
Sure. At a certain time during sleep, souls rise up to the heavenly academy, each soul going to the hall it is associated with. In general terms, the location in the heavenly palace where a person's soul rests at night is commensurate with the spiritual stature they have achieved with their daytime divine service. More specifically, if a person observed a mitzvah, studied Torah, or prayed in a more beautiful and complete manner that day, or went to sleep with words or thoughts of Torah on their mind, they merit a loftier location in heaven. The heavenly palace contains hallways, colonnades, lounges, and halls in which the soul can rest when it rises to heaven to draw new life during sleep.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we have this this description of what happens. So that's we have angels, and that's where our souls potentially go and engage with overnight. And then we also have, last point, that the souls are able to communicate divine information to us. So in a dream, or while the soul is in the spiritual realms, engaging with angels, it's possible. Did you ever wake up one morning and you kind of have information or new insight to something that you didn't have the night before? Yes, many are agreeing. Why is that and how is that? Where did the information come from? If you were sleeping especially, you would think maybe by the end of the day you would have more information or insight than with what you started the day, because you're actually experiencing things. You're meeting people, you're reading or whatever, but the truth is, I mean, of course we do hopefully learn during the day, which we are right now, of course, Torah especially, but there's unique insight that we have access to and we could gain while our soul is actually on high during the time that we are sleeping. Now, we also have a concept called demons, which are impure spiritual beings, and in the context of dreams, a metaphor for products of the mind. So we're not going to get into demons specifically. What we mean, we're kind of going to, this is basically going to describe dreams that don't come from a particularly holy source. In other words, even if we say that a dream just comes from our imagination, it all falls under this this title, meaning it's not from an angel. So it's a metaphor for products of the mind. And now, to summarize what we have over here, we have two potential sources for dreams, as we said. And so when this source are angels, and we and the dream comes from a holy place, because that's what our day was like before we had this dream, then there may be the validity to it, and those dreams can be taken seriously, potentially. And we're going to continue to unpack this. However, when they come from the other category, when they just come from my imagination, then those usually don't really carry much value, and we don't need to attribute value to them, even if it was, let's just say, a bad dream, because it doesn't come from an important source, and we can just ignore it and attribute it to our wild imagination and move along. So now we have some consistency as far as the Talmudic statements are concerned. Let's take a look. We have our imagination versus angels. So when the dream just comes from our imagination, then we have that verse in Hebrew was Chalomot Shav Yidaberu, which means dreams speak falsehood. And we don't need to worry about those, because they're not coming from any credible source, just our imagination. However, when they're coming from angels, which they may have encountered during the night, then we have the other source from the Talmud, that dreams are miniature prophecies. However, we said before that some information in the dream is false. Doesn't mean 100% of it is or has relevance. So again, if the source are the angels, then there may be prophecy there, and that may be something worthwhile to pursue and explore. Any quick questions? So far we came to a reconciliation of these Talmudic sources, but there's more. So yes, Marlene.
What would you say about lucid dreams? Would you say that's more of an interruption to the soul being able to go into a heavenly place? As lucid dreaming is more of your self-awareness of your dream. If you understand.
So you're saying you're fully asleep, but it's a very vivid dream.
As in, you can control it and be interactive with it, interact with whomever's in your dream or whatever's in your dream. Would that be an interruption to...
What do you mean by control? Are you sleeping or not?
You're asleep, but you know you're dreaming. And you're aware of it, and you have control of it.
If the individual is fully asleep, then I would say this is a dream like other dreams. And by the way, we'll talk soon about when a dream is very vivid. We'll come back to it. Yes.
So, just going back quickly, all the dreams in Genesis would be prophetic dreams?
Most certainly, if they're recorded in the Torah, yes. Yes, and we're talking about prophets too. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph,
and Pharaoh.
So there were prophets in the Bible who were wicked, like Bilam famously. He was on par with Moses as far as his prophecy, even though he was a wicked individual. Yes.
No, first of all, I like the idea of being proactive, and you can design your dreaming by doing mitzvah and study Torah, right? It just seems like you can shape your...
And we'll see more of that.
Habits. The only thing that I'm lost, and maybe it's my fault, it's help me understand in a dream what is an angel. Because that's the only part that I remember dreaming, but I remember
I don't even know how an angel looks like.
An angel doesn't have a look, so you're okay. None of us know what an angel looks like.
And we
didn't say that the soul knows that it's engaging with an angel. But when the soul is on high, all we know is the soul returns, like we said before, sometimes with some new insight. But it's not like you know or could attribute it that I heard it from an angel in my dream. That's not how it works. You just have an additional insight or a certain feeling, and we're being taught tonight of what the source of that may be. But it doesn't mean that we actually could identify the exact experience of how we got this information from the angel. And we'll continue to unfold. Stanley.
Initially, I reported that I had dreams 52 years apart that presented me with directives. Now I report that in the dream, the reporter had the same form, dressed the same way, looked the same, and he gave a name to himself.
Really?
Really.
What's the name?
Frank.
Frank?
Frank.
Okay, I look forward to hearing more details soon.
I will repeat that on both occasions, 52 years apart, these were, I guess, the two most significant life events that I had to deal with.
Wow, so that's...
52 years apart.
Let's see how this is going to fit in. Thank you for sharing. Deborah.
Two questions about what he said. Number one, is that why you don't have the demons? Because you really can't, you don't distinguish between the angels and the demons in that section? You have
the demons are associated with our imagination. Not with the angels. The angels those dreams come from a holy place. The ones that just come from our imagination are not coming from any particular or important place. They're just coming from wherever.
One time I had a situation and it was so real, I thought I wasn't dreaming. But I said the Shema, I was really young, and it disappeared. And I thought that would tell me that I saw was bad.
You're saying after the dream, you woke up and said the Shema.
No, it was during the dream. It was.
In the middle of the dream, you said the Shema.
I said the Shema. Interesting. And it disappeared, and I thought this looked really benign, but it must have been really evil. And that's why I was trying to, you know, is there a distinction up there between angels and devils, not where the bad stuff is thrown in with the imagination?
Right. Okay. Let's advance because we have more to cover and. Not tons of time. So let's do this. So we just established that there's two sources to dreams. The problem, though, is, and I'm sure all of you are thinking this, that when you get a dream, it doesn't come with a return address. And it's not identified of where it's from. You don't know if this one's from an angel or this one's from just from my imagination being possessed by a demon. Who knows? So bottom line, how do we go about determining when we have a dream, what do we do? How do we react? So we're going to try to gain some more clarity on this. And at this stage, what we're really going to do is this. We're going to discuss first a more classic approach. Then we're going to discuss a more Hasidic philosophical approach. First, the classic approach. So when you don't know where a dream is coming from. So bottom line is this. If it's like just benign, meaning there's no like instruction or guidance in the dream, then it's not really that relevant. Meaning, if it was a good dream, a nice dream, fine. And again, if there's no instruction, then it's fine. We could just leave it at that. And that's the case for the vast majority of dreams. Now, the question though is, what happens when it was a dream that did come with some instruction or something practical and you need to know how to act? So if it was positive, like it told you to go to a certain place because there's a treasure of money there, then it's up to you. You don't have to go follow the trail, but if you want to, you can go follow it. There's no harm here. So, and if it turns out good, and you do find something, then wonderful. no harm is done. There's only possible benefit, of course. But when the dream contains a statement, let's just say, like we said before, that the money is sacred, or that the money belongs to a certain charity, let's just say, or belongs to a certain organization, you don't need to respond to that. Now, again, you can, but you're doing so because you want to do so, not because the dream dictates or defines the status of anything in reality. It's up to you if you feel like you want to do that. So let's try to advance here. So how can we identify the source of a dream and assess how seriously it could be taken? So it depends what it is, what type of dream it is. Like I was just saying, if it's just a simple, there are simple visions, and then there are the practically relevant. And depending on which category it falls into, then that's what we do. We can either if it comes from imagination, which means that it doesn't really carry any weight, or if it comes from angels, that they're mini prophecies. So the problem is here that we don't know which way to go. There's doubt as to exactly which address it's coming from. So in that scenario, then if it's giving you an instruction, like telling you what to do with money, then you don't need to honor that at all. However, if it's a bad dream, let's say somebody has a very bad dream, and they feel like they really want to do something about it, then Jewish law gives somebody permission to fast, and they can even fast on Shabbat. In other words, if you really are distressed, again, you don't know exactly where the dream came from, but there's something, maybe something that was said about the future, and you're uncomfortable with it, then you can fast. Again, we'll talk more if it's relevant in reality. In general, we don't promote fasting, but there's permission to do so. So this is the classic approach, and we're going to advance more, and I think the next idea will help us. Yes?
Very quick question, because I'm trying to also understand, if I dream 10 times a week and 80% are imagination versus angels, that means that I should also elevate myself or even if I elevate myself with, you know, doing more mitzvot, reading the Torah, can I clean the imagination part, or still the ritual will be the same, but I will pay attention to only to the angels ones? You know what I mean?
So the 80% you're saying just come from your imagination, not angels.
Correct.
Okay.
And what I'm proposing is it fair to say that the more I elevate myself as an individual or as a positive person, I will reduce the number of dreams?
The answer is yes, and let's advance now. There'll be a lot more insight on this, which I want to cover. Okay, let's continue here. And again, I'll take questions at the end. So we have another approach here, which is the Hasidic approach, which was written to us by a rabbi known as the Tzemach Tzedek, named after his work. He was a grandson of the first Chabad Rebbe, Rabbi Schneur Zalman. And the grandson wrote about his grandfather, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, in text number 13. Are we holding by Stanley, or did you read it already, or not yet?
Yes.
You did already?
No.
Would you like to?
Sure.
13, please. Page 27.
Okay. Who's dreaming? I heard explicitly from my grandfather, a teacher of blessed memory, that one should not be worried at all about such matters like dreams. The teachings in the Talmud that lend great significance to dreams only apply to people of great spiritual stature, whose thoughts are distant. If this person has an uncharacteristic experience, it must be divinely orchestrated and is therefore a cause for concern. However, a person whose thoughts regularly wander through such matters has no reason for concern. My grandfather repeated this many times and dismissed people that were miserable as a result. You should completely ignore this and be joyful.
Thank you very much. So let's get into this a little bit, and relatively we're going to have to do it a little bit concise. There's two types of people. Okay, let's just say. There are certain people who they own their thoughts. In other words, what they're thinking, they welcome the thought in to their mind. So they own their thoughts. That's one. The other one is that somebody's thoughts own them. It's almost like the thought welcomes my mind into the thought. I don't choose what thoughts to bring into my mind like the other person. They're just controlled by outside influences of what to think about. In other words, there's two different types of people. And in a way, this has to do with earlier generations and more versus more recent. And that is that it used to be that people had much more control over their mental focus. And throughout the whole day, whatever they're doing, they are making choices of what to engage their mind in. And basically, if we're making choices, then the vast majority of the day, if not the whole day, our mind is involved in important things, whether it's actually studying Torah or doing our work or engaged in pursuing a mitzvah or helping somebody. Our mind is focused on good things and important things versus more recent times where that's less and less of the case. And we can also attribute it, and I think everybody could relate to it, to the fact that unlike back in the day when they lived in villages, nowadays, even from television, most certainly nowadays when we have phones and we don't even realize, but we're just, things are flashing before our eyes. Most of what flashes before our eyes, we don't even think about because that's how much there is. It's so overwhelming and there's so much stimuli that things are entering our mind most certainly without us even knowing it. So nowadays, the vast majority of people don't have the capacity to focus like people used to. So Rabbi Schneur Zalman is writing that because of that, when we have a dream, or when somebody who's a super righteous person, let's just say a tzaddik or a few in the generation, people that control their thoughts 100% of the time, when they have a dream, then there's value to it, because it's coming from the things that they think about and that they're engaged in. And being that a whole day they're in control of their thoughts, then when they dream, it's also a result of them being in control of their minds. But for the rest of us, where our minds just run wild and we don't control our thoughts throughout the day, and we don't have that focus, then when we dream, it's just a result of that. And therefore, they always instructed and guided people that came to them about bad dreams to totally not worry about it, because we were not talking about people who were on the stature of having the focus of people that existed in earlier times, and therefore totally ignore the dream. But there are exceptions. And some of you mentioned some of these ideas before. And some of the commentaries mentioned these as well. So it could be that, at least I could speak for myself, that I'm not from those that have 100% control of my mind. So the question is, when we do have a dream, bottom line, what do we do about it? Should we just ignore it 100% of the time? What about that fellow who I met in Israel who was told to go to Rabbi Shimon, or that your child is in the hands of Shimon? Should he have ignored it? Most certainly not. So how do we know? So number one, if you have a dream, if a dream repeats itself at least three times, it's not to be ignored. The same dream three times, at that point, it calls for, it deserves attention. If it happens once, even a second time, not necessarily, a third, it means that there's a message there, and the message needs to get across to you, and it's going to keep coming back until you do something about it. Number two, if it's a very vivid dream, if it's extremely real. So another one of the commentaries say that a dream like that is not to be ignored. And another commentary says that if a certain dream is making us extremely anxious and very unsettling, then that too should not be ignored. So now the question is, what do we do in reality? So what we have, we mentioned before the idea of fasting. Now, generally speaking, fasting is not so recommended nowadays, because fasting is disruptive to our life. That's the reality. We're not people in today's generations. Fasting doesn't come so easy. And if we fast, we're not going to be able to focus properly on what we need to do, or we become grumpy and we lash out at the people around us. That's totally counter to anything we're trying to achieve by fasting. So it's not necessarily the way to go. There's another way. So prayer, of course, is something that we should do. And you may be surprised to know that in the prayer book that we use here, there is actually a prayer about dreams. And we recite it regularly. It's fixed to be said and recited on holidays during the priestly blessing, what we call in Yiddish duchening, when the Kohens go to the front of the synagogue and bless the congregation. Towards the end of their blessing, there's a prayer which we actually recite in a very quietly while they're giving their blessing, and it's a prayer for peaceful dreams. And let's actually read the prayer. Would you like to read it for us, Hetty? Number 14 on page 29, if you're comfortable with it.
Master of the universe, I am yours, and my dreams are yours. I have dreamed a dream, and I do not know what it is. May it be your will, my God, and the God of my fathers, and all my dreams, that all my dreams concerning myself or concerning any other Jew shall be for the good, whether dreams I dream about others, or whether others dream about me. If there are good dreams, strengthen them and reinforce them, and may they be fulfilled in me and in them, like the dreams of Joseph. But if they require a remedy, heal them like Ezekiel, king of Judah, and his illness, like Miriam, the prophetess, from her leprosy, like Naaman, from his leprosy, like the waters of Marah by Moses, and like the waters of Jericho by Elisha. As you changed the curse of the wicked, Balaam, from a curse into a blessing, so shall you change all my dreams concerning myself and concerning all of Israel to good. Guard me, be gracious to me, and favor me.
Thank you very much. So that's a prayer which we actually say on holidays, but it also can be said whenever you feel like, if you had a dream and you're distressed by it and you feel like you do want to say a prayer, so you can say this prayer whenever. And if you're in synagogue, we actually do so on any given day when the person leading the service is actually saying the priestly blessing before Sim Shalom towards the end of the repetition of the Amidah. That would be the appropriate time to say this prayer. And then when everyone answers Amen to the cantor's blessing, it actually refers to your blessing too. And if you need help with that at any given time, feel free to reach out to me separately.
So, in the Chabad prayer book, is there the bedtime Shema?
Yes. Give me a second. We'll come to that in a second. So to sum up, what Rabbi Schneur Zalman is teaching us is this. We asked before, ultimately, how do we know? When we have a dream, how do we determine where it's coming from? What Rabbi Schneur Zalman told us is this, that it's a lot less about the contents of the dream and much more about the dreamer. It depends who is having this dream. If it's somebody who, like we described before, whose thoughts are very controlled, then there's a much better chance that there's value to it. If that's not the case, if we are of the wandering mind category, which is most of us, I would assume, then we have much, much less to worry about because our dreams are just as wild as our very thoughts are on any given day. So the key is So if necessary, we should... when we have a dream, we have to think seriously about ourselves. Are we a focused person or not? And if we're not, don't attribute much value to a dream. If still it falls into one of those categories where we can't ignore it, so number one, we don't do anything radical. We don't do things that disrupt our dream. If a dream tells you to sell your house, we do not act. If it tells you to sell your car, we do not act. A colleague, a rabbi, said that somebody once came to the synagogue and told the rabbi, I had a dream, I saw God, and God said that you should give me money. So the rabbi said, if you had a dream that God came to you and said you should give me money, then I'll believe you. So if you're told something that would be considered a disruption to life, then we never do that. Because that would be something radical, and dreams don't have that power, like we said before. At the same time, we really shouldn't get carried away. We shouldn't become too distressed, even from a negative dream. And there's one category of dreams that we always should pay attention to. If you encounter positive inspiration in a dream, if for whatever reason in a dream you feel like you were inspired, you wake up and you feel like inspired to give charity, to get involved in a cause, to attend a Torah class, or to go to synagogue, or to help somebody, a dream like that is always good to respond positively to. First of all, even if you didn't have the dream, it's a good thing to do. But most certainly, if you're having it, it's clearly an extra special good thing to do. So, in conclusion, we're just going to close with a fascinating response from the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, that he wrote to somebody when they wrote to him. So I'll give you a little bit of the backstory. Somebody wrote a letter to the Rebbe saying that he had he's been afflicted by bad dreams for years. He said he went for help to many interpreters, never got the help that he needs. And then he said that he had this one dream where he was very angry at the injustice that he sees in the world. This was what he wrote. And he said to himself in the dream that considering the state of affairs of the world, that he should ascend from this world. This is what he saw in the dream. He wanted to know what it means and what he should do about it. So let's take a look. Jeannie, would you like to read? If you're comfortable reading, text number 15 on page 32, please. Very fascinating how the Rebbe basically interprets his dream for him, but does so very much aligned with the very dream that he had. Let's see. If you don't mind, I'm just going to interject between the paragraphs here because there's a few important points. So number one, the general rule is that when God needs to communicate to us, he did so already through the Torah. He doesn't rely on dreams to speak to us. So as a general rule, that's not how we get communications from God. And whatever God needs us to know, basically, we were already told in the Torah. And if we're not sure, we can get help, we can get assistance of how to gain insight, but it's all there already. Now,
when one isn't observing God's instructions given in the Torah, one may sometimes receive a hint regarding this in a dream or the like.
Sometimes, yet, if we need a reminder, if we're not getting the message through the ordinary channels, sometimes God needs another way to get us a message. Thank you. Continue, please.
Stated in the code
Thank you very much. So how did he conclude to this individual? God wouldn't be communicating to you in a dream what you need to do to fix injustices of the world, because you can't. So quite frankly, it's not what he would be telling you to do. What he would tell you to do is pick up on he would give you a hint to a message that you weren't getting up until now, and you need a special invitation for. And that is using the very language that this individual used in his dream. What he did point to is, if anything, you should express your anger towards the injustices in your own life and fix those areas in your life which may not be aligned up until now with the divine will. And that's how you'll ascend, so to speak. You'll uplift your own life from where it was to a much better place. So, in closing, this is really a tremendous insight. And of course, the Rebbe, being the Rebbe of our times, has the most insight that we need and the best perspective that we need when it comes to dreams. And in closing for real this time, let's quickly take a look at text 16. Tyler, would you please read number 16 for us?
Regarding disturbing dreams, it is well known that the sages teach about this, that people only see in their dreams the products of their own thoughts. Dreams are the result of idle daytime thoughts, and when the cause is reduced, the result will automatically be minimized. You should be particular about reciting the bedtime Shema and ensure that the mezuzah of your bedroom is kosher.
Thank you very much. So in closing, and this is also an answer to what we could do to avoid whether it's nightmares or any negative dreams, we could take action in advance, and that is, and it was mentioned before, something that I do every night, we recite the Shema before going to sleep, and in so doing, it's a few moments of prayer, so it puts you in the right frame of mind. And it's a prayer for a peaceful sleep and dreams. There's a closing blessing there. It's called Hamapil. It's in the prayer book. Another suggestion is that perhaps make it a habit that right before going to sleep, we should fill our minds with something positive. There's a huge variety of books that you could read. It could be stories. It could be something light, but something content that's inspiring, not from the television, which is... At any time of day, it's putting negative thoughts into our minds, most certainly at a critical time when we're closing and retiring for the night, and our minds are going to be influenced by the final thoughts of the day. Most certainly, a great thing would be is to read some good content and positive, uplifting stories or ideas. And finally, to make sure that we have a kosher mezuzah on the doorpost of our bedroom. And that is what the Rebbe wrote to this individual who was struggling with dreams, because doing so brings an additional dose of blessing into those inhabiting that particular space. So the bottom line key is that it all depends on us. We have the ability. Number one, we have control. Even if we have a dream, we have the ability to turn things around through prayer, through repentance, and through straightening things out. And additionally, we can do things, as we just said, in advance to set us on a good path and our minds on a good path, so that we should be spiritually aligned, so that when our soul does ascend on high, it should do so and encounter the angels that we would like it to. Thank you very much for joining, and we will continue with